Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. This is episode 3 of our Wayne Jett series on the Great Depression, what you did not learn in school. And this episode will finish up with the Great Depression era and set it up to move into World War II and set it up past that to move into economics and decisions with Nixon and the gold standard, the 2001 tech crash and the 2008 crash, and today. Lots of information that's going to be shared here. I also want to say that if there's a historian or an economist that really disagree with this, please send me a note. We can set up a debate with you and Wayne Jett, and we can get that information out there. The point of this isn't to bring false information. The point is to bring the truth and to bring the historical facts out in the open for people to understand and know. Understanding history makes us better for the future, and that's what we're all about here. Everything that Wayne Jett has is backed up by documents and facts. And so if you have alternative documents and facts that paint a different picture, please come forward. And like I said, we'll do a debate and we'll get to the truth through an open debate and discussion. The point is to get to the truth so that people are educated on what really went on. So let's get into that interview now with Wayne Jett. Hi, Wayne. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me again, Sarah.
Well, I'm excited to get back into this because I have had an avalanche of positive comments from what you brought to the table last time. A lot of new information that people were completely unaware of. Of course, we're not learning this in our schools. And so to hear a different perspective and to get new information is something I think that we all really appreciate.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate the generosity of your audience and their comments. And this is exactly why I wrote the book. It's something that I had to do once I had researched it and learned what the truth was. So I couldn't hold it back, and that's why I'm still doing what I'm doing here today. And this is a great opportunity for me to pass it along. Thank you.
Well, let's get back into the Great Depression, because I know you had some final points that you wanted to make, and there was a few major points that you didn't cover. So you want to cover a few more major points and then summarize the Great Depression, and then we can get into some more other topics in the timeline of your book.
All right, I'll do that. First, the three big wrongs that Hoover did. He was very popular and could have stopped any one of the three. First was he didn't stop securities fraud on the stock exchanges. He signed Smoot-Hawley when he could have said a word and it wouldn't have passed. And that shut down world trade. Then he proposed and then signed a tax hike that was a monster in 1932, quadrupling the lower rate and even covering some people who'd never had to pay taxes.
Now, can I ask you quickly about that tax hike? Did they make or sell it to the American people, or did they just do it? I mean, how did they get away with that? Because we wouldn't accept a 4x tax hike now.
Well, the people in the country were on their back. I mean, by 1932, you're talking about major unemployment. And in the circumstances, they just did it. Obviously, the people didn't want it, but supposedly it was a matter of good government that we had to make sure and balance the budget. He was spending more money by far than Coolidge had, so he decided he needed higher taxes, and so he didn't think they'd be that high, but the Democrats were happy to help him lose the election that was coming up that year, and that's what they did. So it was done over practically the dead bodies of many Americans, but it was done. Now, FDR was elected in a landslide to do exactly the opposite. He was elected to reverse those three things or to do the opposite. But what he did was the opposite of what he was elected to do. He added taxes every year he was in office, except for 1939. I'll tell you that about that in a minute. One of his first acts, he issued an executive order in March of the same month he was inaugurated, and ordered that all gold be turned in, all privately owned gold, except you could keep 1 ounce per person, and he paid $20.67 for it. Now, last week I said, yes, I do in my book, that that was a devaluation of the dollar by about 41%. But I want to make it clear that's only one way to calculate the amount of devaluation. That's plenty, of course, but it's the most generous way to calculate it to make it seem as small as possible, because 40.9% is he added to the price of gold $14.33 to make it $35. And if you divide that by $35, it's 40.9%. So that's one way to calculate it. But if you look at it from the standpoint of the average American who had the gold and was required to turn it in, he bought it for $20.67 an ounce. So that was his out-of-pocket cost. Roosevelt could have easily simply done the devaluation first, said, I'm increasing the price of gold to $35 an ounce. And if he had done it that way, every person with an ounce of gold would have a 69% increase in the number of dollars he had. Therefore, he would have had a much larger asset from which to support his family. There would be, have been more money in the economy. Instead of having that 69% gain, he had nothing but the original $20.67 and prices of assets otherwise were increased. In other words, to, if he even could buy it back, he would have to pay $35 an ounce. So from that standpoint, it was a 69% plus, almost 70% devaluation that took that much of the assets out of the economy. So we get past that point, and on the tax increases, I told you he increased them every year. The third thing he did is he was supposed to reduce tariffs, and he appointed Hull, Cordell Hull, as Secretary of State, very much for low tariffs. Cordell Hull went to an international conference in July of that year in London to do exactly that, to negotiate reduced tariffs. And while he was there, about ready to make the deals, Roosevelt made a speech from Washington saying that he would never agree to refrain from devaluing our currency. Well, currency was very well understood as the devaluation, sort of the flip side of tariffs. That is, it's the way you get an advantage over the people you trade with. And so with Roosevelt saying that he would likely devalue the dollar, that's the same thing as saying your tariff deal is going to be worthless. So that blew up that London conference. Everyone went away mad, and Cordell Hull was severely embarrassed. So it was a deliberate kind of thing that did much more damage to our foreign relations than had to be done. But that was the way it occurred. No tariff reduction. So instead, at the same time, he was already starting to buy gold with the tax dollars he was collecting. Again, it was March 15th of 33 when all the tax increases from 32 were due.
So why were they buying gold versus feeding the people? Did they give a reason?
He said his excuse was he had a professor that was telling him that if he got the price of gold higher, that it would increase the prices of other commodities, including farm products, and therefore the farmers could get back on their feet and so forth and so on. It wasn't true at all, and most people were saying so, and it didn't happen. At the same time, he was doing things that were just monstrous. I mean, if you were thinking about his state of mind, one of the things that he ordered that year is that they slaughtered 2 million baby pigs and buried them so they wouldn't grow into bigger meat animals that could feed people. They poured milk into the streets. They plowed under crops. It was all so-called to get prices higher. But the reason that the prices were not higher, were lower, was because of what he was doing with the devaluation of the currency. That is, making the dollar more scarce, more expensive.
Nobody could afford it either. Nobody had any money. So
that's exactly the point. The major description that people would give you of the circumstances in the country would be, nobody has any money, very clearly reflecting that what he did was soak up and take away the cash in the currency, the cash in the economy, so that it was even worse than the devaluation. Again, he could have put out more dollars to devalue the dollar. He did the opposite. He devalued the dollar but took it away, in terms of took the dollars away instead of adding them.
Well, and he could have given the baby pigs to each family. There's 2 million of them.
Oh, my goodness. It's so sad when you get into the particulars of it. But let me add on some other things that he did on the securities fraud. In 33, they passed an act that said it's a crime to do securities fraud. But it didn't define fraud, and it didn't prescribe a penalty, so it was completely worthless. So the next year, in the 34 Act, they did the act establishing the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and it did it exactly in the way that made the SEC a monster from mob headquarters. It created a commission, politically appointed, that would have complete charge and complete discretion to decide what, if any, so-called fraud to investigate, and who should be prosecuted. And who did he appoint to that commission, which became its first chairman, the one responsible for hiring its entire staff, the permanent staff that would be there to administer the law and to use this discretion? He appointed Joseph P. Kennedy, probably the most notorious trader on Wall Street during the 20s. By the time Joe Kennedy left that post, a year after his appointment or so, he had everyone in place, making sure that his friends were there so that they would never come after him or any of the big people on Wall Street. That's been the history of it. The law is still to the same effect today. The SEC does not go after big guys. They waited 8 years to go after Bernie Madoff, and they didn't go after him then. Bernie Madoff, in his so-called $60 billion scandal, turned himself in, or he would never have come to public light. And he did that in order probably to keep the mob from killing him, the financial mob. So we have that kind of thing that very much affects what happened in the tech crash and in the financial terrorism of 2008. I'll get into that later. But that was the thing that FDR did. Again, this is the kind of thing that goes to the state of mind. What's in the mind of these people? Are they really trying to do the right thing and they're just making mistakes? Absolutely not, in my opinion. But I'm going to go ahead and tell you some more about what he did. I told you last week that during his first 8 years in office, he bought with tax money 13,185.3 metric tons of gold, mostly from foreign markets, some of it from domestic mines. But in any event, that was more than twice as much as all the gold accumulated in the country up to 1930. Now, let me tell you about the 1930 amount. It was something over 6,000 tons, and that was up tenfold from the 600 tons or so that the country had in 1900. So I told you the last time we spoke, those first 30 years were very profitable. They increased the gold reserves through commercial activity, through economic activity. The reserves of the United States increased 10 times over during those 30 years. So indeed, it was very prosperous. But it was through economic development, economic trade, rather than simply going out and buying the gold on foreign markets the way Roosevelt did. So between 1933, when he took office in March, and 1940, he bought those 13,185 metric tons, which was more than twice as much as we had accumulated in all of our history up to 1930. So in that circumstance, we had more than tripled the amount of gold in the treasury, and it was all taken out of the money of the economy through taxation. Now, let me add a next step that he took at the same time he was buying all this gold. In 1935, he had had the Federal Reserve Reform Act passed, which really gave him the power to appoint more people, and he effectively, FDR, effectively took control of the Federal Reserve. Its new chairman was a man named Mariner Eccles, who was not a banker. He was from Utah. And so I interpret that appointment as being to make it look like just the common man was now in charge of the Fed. In that circumstance, what did the first thing the Fed do after it was reconstituted? In July of 36, even though the banks had recovered, there was no problem of the banks failing any longer. The reserves were regarded as soundly placed. Nevertheless, the Fed increased reserve requirements for bank lending by 50%.
So people were just getting nailed left and right from every direction conceivable.
And so the banks had to call in loans. They had to foreclose in order to meet the 50% increase in the reserve requirements. It was a dramatic reduction in their lending power, especially, of course, for smaller banks. And they have to go out and foreclose on farms. They have to foreclose on small businesses. All those people are thrown out of job and out of work. When their property is sold at foreclosure, it's a fire sale. They get practically nothing for it. The small amount they get into the banks is not enough to pay off the bank loan. So it causes bank failures. The people are out of work. And the large agricultural companies particularly got a great opportunity to go in and buy that land at foreclosure and take farming properties all over the country. Supposedly, with Roosevelt being portrayed in the press as if he's favoring the farmers, and he was the one causing it. In January 37, after he's reelected in 36 to his second term, the Fed does it again and increases the reserve requirements by another 33%.
Wow.
I mean, this is nothing but absolutely the most vicious kind of financial
How would you compare
victimization that you can imagine?
How would you compare their reserve requirements back then to what we have now?
Their reserve requirements were far more conservative. Back in those days, the banks had a rule that they could lend only 10%, 10 times the amount of capital on deposit with them. So therefore, in that circumstance, it was what's called fractional reserve banking, no doubt. That was the general rule. Obviously, they could have higher reserves than the $1 for every dollar loaned out, every $10 loaned out. But, for example, compare that to the lending ratios of the big banks on Wall Street, particularly in 2008. They had leveraged themselves up to 100 times capital. I mean, as a matter of fact, we don't even know how much their leverage was. At least I can't call it to mind. But it was far higher leverage, and those banks were bailed out for whatever reason. It's very unclear as to exactly why they had the financial problems or why they deserved any money at all. But back in the time of the Great Depression, the banks were not bailed out. There was no money put into them. They simply had to close their doors if they didn't have the additional reserves that were required by the Fed at that time. So
now, were the additional capital requirements the same for all size banks, or were there different rules for the smaller banks versus the larger banks?
They were applicable to all banks.
Okay.
So you can be sure that the big banks were in a position to meet them, or they wouldn't have been adopted, because clearly the big banks were in charge of the Fed. Mm-hmm. I mean, they own the Fed. It's a privately owned bank. I say that FDR controlled it. Obviously, the political forces controlled it, but he was controlled by the same forces that controlled it and owned the big banks. So that is the way that worked out. It was not going to be – there was a very strong motive at that time, and it remains today. The big banks want as few small banks competing with them as possible. The so-called Reform Act of 2010, Financial Reform Act passed by Congress, allowed the big banks of Wall Street to go wall to wall through all other states – as a federal matter, as opposed to allowing the states to control it. That's why you now see Chase Manhattan out practically on every corner in every state. I mean, at least the states they want to be in. And so it is still an outrageous circumstance that we have with the influences that they impart on the Congress. Now, let me get to another point of what was done during the Depression that drastically affected. We've got those foreclosures now clearly in mind. These are the farmers and small business being thrown out of their businesses and closed up because simply a ruling adopted by the Fed that greatly reduced bank lending power. Sterilization of gold from Europe in 1936. Here is what happened. FDR, someone tipped him. It's not clear who did. It wasn't from Morgenthau, as best I can determine. Someone told Franklin Roosevelt that the Europeans, remember there were war drums sounding over there with Europe. There were many Europeans who were deciding they'd better get out of Europe because the war was coming. And so they were selling, liquidating their businesses, and they were using their money to buy American dollars in order to invest over here. When that happens, the foreign currency that the U.S. gets in exchange for dollars is then used to buy gold. And it was coming in. That's the normal process of commerce. When investors are buying dollars with foreign currency, the foreign currency is then exchanged for gold, and the gold flows into the U.S. Someone tipped FDR that $7 billion in gold was coming in for that reason from Europe in 1936. Now, $7 billion was a lot of money in the economy at that time. You're talking about an economy at that time that was like in the $30 billion plus range. So $7 billion would have been a shot in the arm. And it would ought to have been lauded as fantastic news. FDR contacted Morgenthau and Mariner Eccles, the head of the Fed, and said, he's very worried about this hot money coming in from Europe. Those Europeans are likely to change their mind a few years down the road and jerk that money out of the country. And we'd have this upset economy and so forth and so on. You've got to do something to make sure that this gold is not monetized. Get rid of this hot money issue. Well, obviously, as we've just said a few minutes ago, the depression condition was no one has any money. The best thing that we could have would have some additional money in the economy. But he pressed Morgenthau to tell Eccles at Fed, we're not going to monetize this gold. We've got to somehow sterilize it. So Morgenthau pressed Eccles. Eccles fought back about it. He even wrote a formal letter to Morgenthau saying that there is no good reason not to monetize this gold that's coming in. It's on our shores. It's in our vaults. It belongs to us. Our obligation under the gold standard is to monetize it, issue dollars in the full amount of the gold, and get it into the economy. If it turns out we have any inflation from it, he said, we can easily soak that up by selling government bonds. That's exactly the way the Fed still does it, if there's any such thing as too much money in their definition. But nevertheless, Morgenthau, at Roosevelt's insistence, held his ground and said, nope, we're not going to resolve it this way. So FDR intervened. He called them both to the White House, and Eccles buckled and yielded. And I said, okay, Mr. President, I guess it is hot money, and we'll work out how we're going to sterilize it. Well, essentially, what they did is simply agree that none of the gold would be monetized. That is, no dollars would be issued based upon it. They wrote regulations to that effect, immediately put into effect, no dollars on this gold. And guess what turned out to be in the regulations when the regulations came out?
What?
They sterilized even purchases of gold from the Treasury from domestic U.S. mines.
Oh, so they expanded it way past what this European money was or gold was.
That's correct.
Now, did the European gold end up prove out to be hot, or did it prove out to be good?
No, of course not. Mm-hmm. It did not at all. And
then they didn't reverse it at that time.
It remained in our vaults and became a part of the tremendous store of gold that made the U.S. the imperial power. There's one reason that the mercantilists believed was gave a reason. The real reason behind accruing a tremendous gold reserve in a country is when that country is preparing to launch war or preparing to fight war. And it certainly put us in the position of being the dominant war power in the world at the beginning of World War II. And of course, we still had that gold. The reason it enables you to fight wars is because it provides reserves from which you borrow against in order to pay for your war, so that nobody's going to outgun you, nobody's going to outman you, and so forth. So it's the kind of thing that imperialists have done for far longer than the 20th century. But in all of that circumstance, and these actions that Roosevelt was taking, he was not only completely impoverishing the American public and starving them to death. He was also destroying the gold standard, the international gold standard that had allowed many countries to prosper and grow, because as they produced and sold goods, they could increase their gold, they increased their money supply, and that made their economy prosper even more. The ones who sold the most could then increase their money supply, and then they could buy the most by increasing their money supply. So the destruction of the gold standard, I believe, was a deliberate objective. When the gold buying plan of FDR became known to the rest of the world in 1933, into 1933, the word got out, and the chairman of the Bank of England. Normally, it's a very reserved institution that's very careful in what it says to the public, very conservative and so forth. When the head of that bank learned about the gold plan, he said, "This is the worst news yet. The entire world will be bankrupted." Now, when I first read that, I just didn't understand what about gold buying would have upset him so much. I finally realized that it's because he knew the rest of the plan, that is, the gold was not going to be monetized when it got to the U.S., and therefore it would shrink the supply of gold in the U.S., and it would destroy the gold standard itself among the trading nations.
Now, who do you think was giving pressure to FDR to do that? Do you think FDR knew what he was doing, or do you think he was the powers behind him were forcing him to do it and he didn't quite understand?
Well, I feel quite certain he understood, because he was given the lead. He was regarded as the most, as for example, the author that I told you about last time, who wrote that manifesto, H.G. Wells, he called him continuously revolutionary. Roosevelt was trusted so much by the ruling elite to do their bidding, he could even use his own imagination, because he knew how to keep the people in line without their objecting too much, and still do exactly what they wanted to do. And all of this activity was really precisely as the manifesto had outlined their intention. They wanted, before I go into that, though, may I go ahead and just cover a couple of additional items, and we can wrap this up about the Great Depression.
Yeah. Go ahead.
On that basis, 1939, I told you last time, was the 1 year that taxes were not increased because Congress wouldn't do it. They had lost 83 seats in the House in the 1938 election, and it was because the Depression had gotten so much worse. It was called, by that time, it was called Roosevelt's Depression. So we get to 1939, and Morgenthau records in his personal daily diary that on March 5th of 39, he had lunch finally with Roosevelt. Roosevelt had been on an extended Navy tour aboard the ship or something or other, and he finally got back, and Morgenthau was able to have lunch with him. And at that lunch, he records that he told FDR that he had a plan for cutting taxes, and that if he followed that plan, we would have a boom within a month, an economic boom. Roosevelt listened to him, said he agreed to Morgenthau's request that he be allowed to come over bring his top guy in the Treasury Department and meet with the Roosevelt in the Oval Office and talk over the plan. And he said, I'm going to, you know, obviously FDR was not enthusiastic about it, but he reluctantly agreed to it. And to try to smooth him over a little bit, Morgenthau tells him, I've got this little sign in my office that everybody absolutely loves when they come in to see me. The little sign says, does it help the recovery? It makes them think that we are doing everything. That makes them lets them know that we're working every hour of the day to try to make things better. I'm going to bring you one just like it. And so on the Friday of that week, I believe the 5th was a Wednesday, March 7th, I think, was a Friday, he went over with John Haynes, his number two guy, to present the plan. And Roosevelt listened to them. Then he began his ranting and admonishing them, saying that you're going to get me thrown out of office. My enemies will think they've won. They'll be encouraged. I'll be ridden out of office by a man on horseback. In other words, some military takeover or something or other. And of course, Morgenthau was telling him, "No, Mr. President, no. They would love you. You get us out of this depression, you'll be the greatest president ever. They'll love you for this." And Roosevelt told him no, and he said, "That little sign of yours is very stupid. This is not about recovery. This is a matter of politics." And as Morgenthau and Haynes were leaving the office, going through the door, he raised his voice enough, FDR did, to shout to him, "For God's sake, don't be so innocent." Okay, so how much more do we need to pile on for people to take a close look at this? We still have our politicians in Washington praising FDR as, oh my goodness, one of the greatest presidents ever. I mean, how far back do we have to go to find another one like him? And we haven't had one since.
How did they do that? How did he spin himself into such a great character?
Because the press and the banks, the Congress, and so forth are controlled by the same shadow government that I told you about in the manifesto. It still is. They tell you repeatedly, this is the way things are. The people who dissent are crushed. They are giving no attention. They're thrown out of jobs. They're thrown out of office and so forth. There were dissenters. There was a very well-known Catholic priest out of Detroit area who would go on the radio, had a regular radio show that was castigating FDR. But he was finally taken off the air. Just the same way that pressures today prevent these kind of views from getting out. We still have Republicans praising FDR. My goodness, I had an opportunity to raise a couple of points with the former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, who, when he was running for president in 2012, he came to a town hall, and I was asked to raise some question with him, which I did. And it got at the trading fraud and so forth and so on. I'm not sure exactly what the question was. He had answered a number of questions to from several different people, and I was sort of the last in order. And he answered every one of those other questions. Mine is the only one. He never said a single word in response to it. It's the kind, and he still praises FDR. I think it's partly, and when you're running for president, you don't want to say anything, at least some people don't, out of the ordinary. But it's that kind of thing that still permeates. I'm hopeful that Newt Gingrich is actually one of the good guys now. I don't know. But there are plenty in both parties that are completely dependent upon the establishment to fund their campaigns, to bribe them, to do whatever to make them wealthy people, and they just aren't interested in listening to anything to the contrary.
Well, when you were beginning to research this, what were your initial thoughts? How were you, because you didn't know this at first. So where did you go mentally from where you, when you started to where you ended up?
Well, I was in classical economics, and I was writing, I was representing a firm that I told you about last time that was a good economic forecasting firm. But I found out in writing for them that I was not permitted to say anything about fraud in trading or things that were not on the up and up or really accuse the Federal Reserve of doing improper things that were not what it was telling the public, things of that sort. And so as a result of that, I decided, well, I don't believe them about the Great Depression either. I'm going to go back and research it myself. And the first thing I found about it, I knew where I wanted to go. I went to the published, edited versions of Henry Morgenthau's private diary that were actually published in either two or three volumes back in the 1960s. And with Morgenthau's assistance to the Yale historian who did the editing. And so I wanted to see what I could find in terms of what was really done and what was motivating them. And I found some things. The first thing I found had something to do with gold. I'm not absolutely certain, but I think it was about the sterilization of gold that they were buying. And I knew that I knew enough about classical economics already that I knew that was very significant. That's why I was looking for it. But it's like a needle in a haystack, you know, trying to find these little comments from day to day as to what was going on. And so once I got into that, it was clear that I had to dig deeper, and I found out more about the taxes and all of this stuff that we were talking about, and much more. The research. I've got a couple of other things that I'd like to tell you about. For example, about a man named Norman Dodd. He was in my book from the standpoint that it was known back at the time. Well, no, it was actually divulged in a later book that was written that referred to him. Norman Dodd, at the time of the Great Depression, was a young banker, very well educated, very well connected. He was a banker for one of the major Wall Street banks. He said he had the very unusual experience while he was there that the chairman of the board of that bank, obviously a very powerful man, comes to him and says, we're very concerned about the future of this bank. I'm assigning you to find out what we must do in order to change our practices in such a way, what changes are necessary for us to survive. Take as long as you need. Use whatever resources. You'll have whatever resources you need. You may go anywhere you need to, but get your report to us as soon as you're satisfied with it, and hopefully the sooner the better. He had that experience. He came back, he worked at it for more than a year, something like that, came back and, the best I can tell you about what he told them, which is not very much, is that he told them that they had to, that the banking industry had to return to sound banking practices. That's not very much in terms of either knowing what practices they were following at the time or what they needed to go back to. But nevertheless, that was essentially it. The way I came across him initially is in after that experience occurred. By the way, they didn't do it. He wound up being fired. Even though there was back and forth, they brought him back in offered him that he could stay there and for his full career and retire at a handsome retirement and all that sort of thing. But they wouldn't be able to follow his recommendations. In 1933, it would have to be in the early months before FDR's inauguration. He returned from a cruise in the Caribbean on the Astor yacht. And after he returned from that Caribbean cruise, the Roosevelts in New York had a reception. And for whatever reason, this Norman Dodd was invited to be one of the guests. He encountered Eleanor Roosevelt there and told Eleanor Roosevelt in a private conversation that he was convinced that the Great Depression was man-made and that it could be fixed. It could be stopped. It could be ended. And he knew how to do it. So that was the conversation. After FDR was inaugurated March 15th, sometime in April or May, I believe it was, Eleanor arranged for Norman Dodd to come to the White House for lunch. She sat in on the lunch, as did Henry Morgenthau and the Secretary of Agriculture, whose name was Henry Wallace, I believe. Eleanor asked Dodd to explain his views about the man-made depression and its cure, and he did so. In a half hour or so, he summarized it. As soon as he did, Henry Morgenthau set off on a tirade against him for about a half hour, yelling at him this way and that way and criticizing and complaining and so forth, and then sat quietly and said, well, basically, I've said what I've been sent here to say. And so he didn't say any more. Henry Wallace then spoke up. Henry Wallace said to Norman Dodd, I heard exactly what you said. I agree with you. It is a man-made depression. And if we could persuade others involved that this is true, then I think you're right about the remedy and so forth. But I can tell you this, in my view, that if your proposals were to be made public and be made known to the important people that we must deal with, that you would find no support for them in the financial community. In fact, quite to the contrary. Indeed, if your proposals were put into effect, it would be the end of the United States as a country. And he got up and left.
Interesting.
So that was one of the things that I related in my book. There's another thing. I know that you yourself, Sarah, have interviewed a man very well known, G. Edward Griffin.
Yes.
And in 1982, I believe it was, G. Edward Griffin interviewed Mr. Dodd. A video interview, a very interesting video interview. And
is that available on YouTube?
I believe it is. I know that I believe I might have even stored a recording of it, but I think it would still be available. He related a very, very interesting story, very compelling, and it ties in with your questions and our discussion here today about the wars. Mr. Dodd did not stay with the bank. He did not take the cushy life or the retirement. He left them, and that was a part of his effort was with the Roosevelt White House, which he struck out, of course. From there until 82, he was at various odds and ends about where he could find work. During the 1950s, the Republican Congress, the Republican House, I think it was Republican House, anyway, Congress decided to do an investigation of the large tax-exempt trusts and foundations to see what they were really doing and to see whether the tax exemption was being misused or abused or whatever and so forth. There was a staff assembled to conduct that investigation. Norman Dodd was hired to be the director of that staff. The interview that Griffin made of Mr. Dodd was about that work. And Norman Dodd describes in the discussion that early in his tenure in that job, he sent out letters to several of the big foundations in New York. First and foremost, the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and others, and told them that they would like to have certain records for them, for the committee's use, to see what their activities had been. He first received then a contact from the Ford Foundation's president, who invited him up for a meeting face-to-face. And that in itself is a very interesting meeting. But I'm not going to go into it right this minute. I'm going to skip that one and go to the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He was also contacted by the president of that foundation and invited for a meeting with him in New York. So Dodd went to meet that gentleman as well. He was a younger man and new in the position. And when Dodd came in, he had assembled his legal counsel and various others to assist in the meeting. And when Dodd made his wishes known for access to the records, he said, you know, we can subpoena them, or you can furnish them to us down in Washington. But the president of Carnegie said, no, why don't you just let me propose this. Send in any person you want, and we'll give them full access to our historical records, and they can stay here for several weeks to do it. So Dodd immediately took him up on that, goes back to Washington, and he carefully selects the staff person, a young woman, a very capable lawyer, and one, in fact, who, unlike Dodd, was quite confident and positive about the great good for humanity that the tax-exempt organizations do. She was sent up by Dodd to do that review of the historical records of the foundation, Carnegie, and he gave her some guidelines about what to look for, but gave her pretty much free rein. She communicated back and got documents, made copies and so forth in certain respects. But what she found, she went back and researched the beginning of the Carnegie Foundation, which was in the first decade of the 20th century. Right after 1900, not long after the manifesto came out, but nevertheless, they found that one of the first things that the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace did was investigate. They conducted a long investigation study of what methods are best used to influence a population and change their views and practices and meld their conduct into the approach that you would think benefits society best. They studied that for a period of years up through something like 1908, I think. It might have been longer. But the conclusion they reached was clearly stated. The best conditions under which to do this kind of molding of public thought is under conditions of war. That investigation by that young woman, Dodd describes in the interview in 1982, says that it basically tore her career apart. More as a person, it shook her beliefs. She was never quite the same person again, and drastically affected her. Another of the things that she found was the letter from the Carnegie Foundation to Woodrow Wilson in 1970, telling him to make sure don't let the war end too soon.